Mr. Drake, Reel 20. Right, Mr. Drake, I've given you the official citation, which is from the Public Records Office, of your Military Medal Award. And if you could just possibly read through it.
Yes, it says, says here, number 4464742, Lance Sergeant Drake, Joseph. Action from which recommended. On March 3rd, 1943, while the main enemy attack on Sedgenard was being pressed from the east, fresh threat developed from the north. Lance Sergeant Drake was a member of the party of 20 detailed to delay any new attack. Defensive positions having been taken up, the position was attacked by the two companies after of enemy. This NCO, by continually moving the position of his two brain guns, led the enemy to believe that the positions held a great deal stronger than the fact. By this action, the advance was successfully held up until all ammunition had been exhausted. Very strongly recommended, B. Howlett, Brigadier, and then it's recommended by M.C. Worrell, acting 2IC 16th DLI. Yeah, Honour of Award, M.M.
And I think we should explain it's a very... it's a handwritten document, which is very difficult to read. That's why we've taken the time. Now, so you've never seen this particular document before.
No.
As an explanation of what happened, does it fit what we've?
Well, yes. I did honestly not know until I got this document, by the courtesy of yourself, of course, that it was for the action I'd taken previously, and that's when I stayed behind the Vickers machine gun and let all my platoon get out, and all the men got away without any injuries, and which I, fortunate enough, got away without myself. But I did think it was for that particular action.
And we were talking about this off the tape, and the fact that the officer that you were with at that point, Brian Lacks,
yeah,
was taken prisoner
later on,
not very long later. So this recommendation would probably be on the basis of Captain Balance.
I should imagine so. Captain Balance was with us with the 20 men, and so was Lieutenant Lacks. And I was in charge of the operation, of course, and I did all the running about with the Bren guns wherever they wanted them, where they couldn't cope with the ordinary rifle fire. And
just to go back to that, just briefly, Mr. Drake, the fact that you were put in charge over the officers.
Yeah. Most unusual, of course, but. They was asked if there'd any objections, and no, he particularly asked the two officers, and they said no. So the officers agreed that I should run it, because I probably knew more of the territory than what they did. So I think that was the reason behind it all. Not that I was going to supersede them in any shape or form, but I was more capable of doing it than what they were, because I was more acquainted with all the territory there, and I knew just where I was going to go and why I was going to go there, and it was a good position to take up.
Go back into that action. So what was Captain Valance and Lieutenant Lacks, what were they doing during the engagement?
Well, during the engagement, they were both very busy filling the magazines and for the Bren guns and the clips for the riflemen, which had to be all ready, because once I knew the attack started, that we'd be needing every bit of ammunition we could. Obviously, if two companies of German army is coming up in front of you and you've got them all there, you're going to cause a lot of damage, and you don't want any gun waiting for any ammunition. So they had a full-time job filling the magazines and the clips for the rifles with the bullets.
Could you just explain what the Bren magazine was, the Bren gun magazine?
Well, it contained quite a number of... it was sort of on a bent shape, and you slotted the... I can't recollect just now how many it would hold, but you filled the magazine, which then slotted into the top of the Bren, and of course you could pull the trigger and it would go until the magazine emptied, and then you'd pop another magazine in.
And you could use the same type of bullet?
They were both the 303. The Bren and the rifle was the 303.
Just on that theme, so going back to North Africa, when you were doing these patrols on the road, you'd have your Bren carrying, you'd have your Bren gun.
Yeah.
How many loaded magazines would you have?
Well, each soldier carried a pouch at each side, two pouches, and you could get three magazines into each pouch. So you'd have six magazines, one on the Bren, and each of the complement had six in their pouches, you see. So he carried a fair amount of magazines. It would be 6, 9, 6, 12, 18. There'd be 18 magazines besides the ones you had in the Bren and one on ready to pop in.
And when you were at this position on the decoy operation, this ammunition that had been stored, so some of this would have been loose ammunition, as it
was? Oh, it was all loose ammunition in boxes, and of course it had to be put into these magazines as we emptied them to keep a supply, and we had plenty of magazines. And
so how did the ammunition come in the boxes? What kind of...
They were in oblong boxes.
About how big?
They'd be about 3 foot by 9 inches, or 3 foot by about 12 inches. And of course, that particular place, a new C company had a sort of ammunition dump there, you see. So I knew we didn't expect running short of ammunition. However, we did use it all up, and even to the last of the hand grenades, we even used them up, so we'd nothing left.
Now, right, going back to Killaly Castle, so you were there at BE Day.
Yeah.
Come back from the Investiture Buckingham Palace.
Yeah.
And so was that a case of just the same duties?
Yes, it just carried on with the same duties until I got my notice to that I was to report to a certain place, I don't know where it was now, for demob, and that came under me agent service group. So it was my time to be discharged from the army.
Could you just describe what this agent service group meant? What is that?
Well, all personnel at that time then were being discharged. The war was over and they were being discharged on the agent service group, so that you, it depended on your age and your service you put in as to how soon you got out, you see. So it was all taken in rotation, and when your age and service group came up, you were automatically sent to a depot where you you were kitted out with civilian clothing and discarded your army clothing and returned back home.
Could you describe that process for you?
For me, well, it went quite normal. There were, everybody were doing the same thing, so you were just a matter of elimination when you, as you were sent in to be, you got the, you tried a suit on, and which it, if it fitted, you were all right. If it didn't, they still clasped their handful at the back, and they would, it was still fitted, sort of thing. But mine wasn't a bad suit at all. It was acceptable, but I don't think anybody were grumbling, though, that pleased to be returning home. So it was a pleasant atmosphere all the way around, and couldn't get through quick enough to be going home again.
Where were you demobbed at?
I don't know. I can't think of the place where it was. As I say, you're only there for, say, an hour or two, and then you've got your railway warrant to get back to your station near to your home.
Now, you'd been, and this would be what year? What time?
This was 1946, early 1946, I would say.
Now, you've been in the army for 6 years.
Just short of 6 years, about 5.5 years.
What were your thoughts about your return to civilian life?
Well, I thought, well, that's it. Now I have to think of what we're going to do. However, my brothers were coming out. They'd been, two of my brothers, one older, one younger, they were coming out shortly, so...
Where'd they been?
They'd been in Africa. One had been in Burma and in Africa as well, my younger brother. But my older brother, he'd been in the North African campaign in the 8th Army, whereas I was in the 1st. He was coming out more or less the same time, within a week or two of myself, so I was sort of a bit more closely to him because I'd worked with him before he went into the forces. So,
can you remember what regiments or units they were with?
Yeah, one was with the RAOC, my younger brother, and my other brother was with the RA engineers, the engineers. But they both came back free of injuries, or none of us were casualties in any shape or form, so we were a very lucky family to say three of us had gone and we all three came back unscathed.
How were you changed by the war, do you think?
I don't think it changed my attitude towards life. I thought I couldn't get down to work quick enough. I was offered a job back at the local council, but I wouldn't accept it until I'd had a bit of time off, and I said I'd let them know what I'd decided to do. And when my older brother came back, he wanted to, he decided he wanted to come to Blackpool and start a decorating business. So, but he wouldn't go, he said he wouldn't go without I went with him. He preferred me to go with him than anyone else. So we discussed it with my wife, and she thought it was a good idea, and they wanted, the doctor said it's time they sort of got them to the seaside somewhere, and so they could build themselves up. They was pretty run down. So I thought, well, all in all, I've helped my brother on numerous occasions. I thought, if I can do 24 hours in the army on duty, I can go and do 24 hours on duty for herself, I'm sure. So we decided, and I let the council know that I was what I was going to do. So, and I'd explained that my brother wouldn't go without me, so I says, I'm really obliged to go with him so that I can help him. So we came up to Blackpool, and there I established myself in business, painting and decorating. And we've been in business ever since.
Now, what kind of place was Blackpool in
1946? 1946, well, there were quite a few of the sort of leftovers from families who'd been sent the children here, and in and all the way around the area, so there was quite a fair amount of children about, but they were gradually returning back home. They couldn't get back home quick enough, of course, but there was gradually, that was the period when they were returning home, and the town itself were getting ready to prepare for visitors. But they had, during the war, of course, had both Polish personnel here, and also the RAF, which had a depot down at Squires Gate at that time. And they was quite a while before the Poles seemed to diminish. Although some are still in Blackpool, married Blackpool people, and of course there's a Polish club here. So we have a certain amount of Polish ex-RAF, as they joined the work with the RAF, mostly airmen, and of course with the RAF personnel itself. And they gradually moved out over a period of years, did the RAF, and except them who, of course, lived here and married here. And the town was really turning over from being a host town for refugees and children of families in cities, and it was gradually turning over to its natural resort of accepting visitors. But all the boarding houses and hotels more or less filled with RAF and Polish personnel up to then. During the war, there was quite a big contingent of both army and not so much army, but Polish and RAF personnel here. And of course they were building planes down at Squires Gate. The vicars were building the planes down there. And then they gradually turned over from making planes to making wooden houses and exporting them to Switzerland and such places as that.
Now, so you moved to Blackpool and you set up in business.
Yeah.
And you continued?
Yeah, I've continued in business right away. When I got to the age of 60, I decided it was time to ease off a bit, so I was asked by the Conservative Party to stand as a candidate for them, and I duly got onto the council, and I stayed on the council for 11 years, which was very interesting, although I was still doing my work, and I joined the Masonic movement, so I was still full time until I got a lot of earache from I was doing too much, so I didn't want to give the Masonic up, so I gave I came off the council. I'd done 11 years anyway, so. Although I suppose I was coming up for mayor, really. If I'd have stayed on a bit longer, I would have been the mayor. But anyway, most of my pals who were on the council have all been mayor since then. So present one is, and the past one were both pals of mine. One lives just down the road, he's just come off. Another one has a shop in Coronation Street, he's just gone on. So it's still continuing, although I'm not there.
Now, you were, after you came back to England.
Yeah.
Were you still, when you were in the army, were you still, did you still have the DLI cap badge? Were you still, you know, when you were at Hexham and the various hospitals and stuff?
Oh yes, I carried out. I could have, they said, I could have joined the RAMC, that's the Royal Army Medical Corps, but if I preferred, I could still keep my original regiment, which I always did. I always kept my original regiment.
Now, when you returned to civilian life, did you have any contact with the various regimental associations?
No, once I moved out of the army, that was it. I didn't want to know any more. I didn't want to know. So I never joined the British Legion or any of them. I washed my hands completely.
You had enough.
I didn't even join the Salvation Army.
Right. I thought the way we'd end the interview, Mr. Drake, is possibly to look at the Army Film Unit footage of the first day of the Sedgenham battle.
Yeah.
And if we could look at that and maybe just have some comment from you on that.
Yeah.
But first of all, were you aware at all during your time at Sedgenham, that period, were you aware of the Army Film Unit?
I was never aware that there was an Army Film Unit there. I've only recently got to know that by yourself, of course. You've been the instigator of my knowledge on that.
Right, well, we'll look at that. Right, Mr. Drake, we're now looking at the Army Film Unit footage, which is held by the Imperial War Museum, and its references AYY 3572 and AYY 3574. This was filmed on the first day of the Sedgenham battle, on the 27th of February 1943, and I thought if we just ran the film on the video and just see whether any of the terrain is familiar. Right, Mr. Drake, we've looked at the Army Film Unit footage, and now we're looking at a couple of the stills of the range of hills. And do those hills look familiar?
Oh yes, very familiar. I know this territory off by heart.
What we're looking at is a range of hills, and
yeah.
An area of plain and scrubland in between.
Yeah.
Now, your first action with the Vickers, where do you think that was?
That was on this first hill on the right-hand side.
So that was right to the on the right-hand side?
Right on the right-hand side of the hills, and the valley was on the other side, and then the other hills rising up on the other side of the valley.
So it was on the right of this particular formation?
It was on the right of this particular formation of hills.
Now, when you were involved with the Vickers. Could you see the other DLI troops?
Yes, over on the left, as they are on this still, they were coming up on the left-hand side here, and they were having very... this terrain here, where they are now, actually, was being... The machine gun in the in one of the hills across, which were trained on the bridge over the river, and that was the easier crossing, of course, so they found out they couldn't cross by the bridge, so they'd all have to cross by going over the river. So my first action was to take the Vickers up this hill,
which is on the right.
Which is on the right. And had to engage the machine gun, which was slightly to my left, in the, embedded in the hills further back.
And that's within that formation of hills?
Within that formation of hills, yes. We sent one of the sections with Sergeant Dorman round the infantry.
Right, Mr. Drake, so we're still looking at the still of the first day of the Sedgenen battle. And so you made your progress on the extreme right.
On the extreme right towards the first hill, which we understood Germans didn't occupy that particular hill. So we sent Sergeant Dorman in a section round on the right-hand side so that when we got on the hill, at least we'd be protected from his extreme right, from his right flank. So he proceeded around there. We loaded the mule, and the mule took us as far as we could go up the hill with it, and then we unloaded the mule and the handler took it back. And then we manhandled it, not right to the top, but slightly on the left-hand side. And there I set up the Vickers, and of course we had a Bren gun carrier. Well, a Bren gun, not a Bren gun carrier, no way could it get up there. But I set up the Vickers, and we soon spotted where the machine gun was because of the smoke coming from the gun.
And that's in the V that's of the
slightly to my left, but on the hill front beyond me. So we spotted him right away. As soon as we saw the puffs of smoke coming, we knew he was firing his gun. So I set up the Vickers to engage him, and which we immediately did. As soon as we saw a puff of smoke, we engaged that particular post with our Vickers. Eventually, he quietened down, and he didn't. We didn't hear a lot more from him. Once that had been silenced, then I decided to do something about the mortar, which we knew was implanted between the two hills below, and was he was also operating onto the plains which we just the territory which we just come over.
So you'd managed to get across to this hill,
yes,
on the extreme right on the still from the film.
Yeah,
you'd got across there without any difficulty.
Without any difficulty at all.
Whereas the rifle companies to your left, to your left.
Oh, the rifle companies were attacking the hills on his left,
and they
had difficulty coming over the ground preceding. Attacking the hill because of the mortar and the machine gun which was operating, and my instructions was to deal with the mortar and the machine gun. So having engaged the machine gun and seemed to silence him, there was no more action coming from there. I decided to crawl forward with the Bren further to the perimeter of the hill, keeping flat, of course, until I could see down into the valley below.